It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, last night the House passed the debt ceiling and spending bill. The final tally of the vote was 314 to 117, with 71 Republicans and 46 Democrats voting against the bill. Now, really interesting and of note, more Democrats than Republicans voted to pass the bill to the Senate. So what actually happened last night with the Republican conference? What happened with the Democrats? And most important, what comes next? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, as of course we've been reporting since last night, the House did pass the bill on the debt ceiling increase and the spending reduction, and that has now been tossed over to the other side of the building, over to the Senate, to see what they will do with it. There were some really fascinating moments as you watched the day play out yesterday, and all of those, of course, leading to the ultimate passage last night. And I think there were a few maneuvers that were interesting on the Republican side. There were a few moves that were pretty interesting on the Democratic side of the aisle. So let's start with Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who last night said this was a unique coalition, 314. We don't get a lot of 314 tallies in the House of Representatives these days. And so this was an interesting coalition that negotiated and ultimately passed the bill.
The president would have never even met with us. He denied meeting with us for 100 days until we passed something and the Senate did nothing. The House Democrats said they'd never vote for anything until the president came down and told them this was their deal. They weren't in the room. So that's a unique coalition, that we pass a bill, you negotiate around our bill, and the Democrats in the day join us to vote for it. I'll take that every day of the week.
That was definitely had the Speaker of the House feeling good about what had been done, that he framed the bill, that the Democrats had to respond to that, that the president got on board on a few of those things. Now, there's plenty inside the bill that you can debate and say, wait, well, does this really do that? Does it really do that? What's it really going to help in the end? So there's a lot of debate left to be had on what is actually in there, what it will actually do in terms of the deficit spending that we continue to have year over year, and ultimately the debt that we've got to pay as a country. Speaker McCarthy was asked about the fact that more Democrats voted for this bill than Republicans. Here's how he responded.
It's difficult in a time of negotiations to keep your full conference abreast, because as we do, you all leak it, and you can't negotiate once you leak, and so something blows something else up.
Now, nobody caught that in the headline, but I think what Speaker McCarthy said there is really significant. The fact that in order to have real negotiations, you have to have an element of trust. You have to have the confidence that it's not going to get leaked, or that it's not going to be somebody else's headline in some publication the next morning. Because once it's leaked, then something blows up. And we're going to come back to that maybe tomorrow and talk about the fact that if we can't have that trust, then it really is tough to negotiate. I love that the speaker called it out. Because what he was really doing is he was calling out Republicans and Democrats alike. He was calling out staff members, Republican and Democrat alike. And he was calling out the media to say, look, if all we do is chase headlines and leaks, it is really hard to have an honest brokered deal. Because everything just blows up. Because so-and-so said this and so-and-so said that. And this was leaked as part of the deal. And someone reacts to that. That's a really important under-the-headline thing that nobody's talking about today, but it might have been the very most important thing that Speaker McCarthy said last night, is in order to negotiate, you have to have trust and you can't have leaks. Speaker McCarthy went on to say that they're doing things a little differently in the House now. They're not doing the 1,000-page bill that no one has any time to read. They actually had 72 hours.
No more omnis. No more business that way. This place has changed. This was a 99-page bill. I'll get to the answer. You had 72 hours to read it. The majority, 15 pages, were just rescissions, things that we are taking back. What this does, by January 1st, encourages this body to pass all 12 appropriation bills. Don't give us an omni. Do the job you're elected to do. And if not, a 1% cut across the board.
Also very important, not in the headlines today, that getting that body, getting Congress to actually do their job. He mentions those 12 appropriations bills. It's one of the few things that's outlined in the Constitution for Congress to do. There's 12 appropriations bills to fund the government. They need to go through committees. They need to each be individually voted on the floor of the House, the floor of the Senate, and sent on to the president. And we haven't done that for decades. Both sides equally responsible. Nobody's getting it done. And so what do? We end up with this omnibus that Speaker McCarthy talked about. 1,000-page bills, middle of the night. Nobody reads it. Everyone keeps it going. And that's what keeps our spending problem rolling. And so this bill, if nothing else, will say, look, if you don't get your job done when you're supposed to get it done, there'll be a 1% cut across the board. Everything. It's going to hurt everybody. Now, I don't think 1% is enough, but an important process piece. And we're going to put a pin in that because we'll watch that as we move through the summer and into September when those appropriations bills are supposed to be done. Finally, Speaker McCarthy told the press that he was going to put together a commission to deal with the debt and deficit problem.
But we're not going to solve our debt problem by trying to do it during a debt ceiling. I'm putting a commission together as Speaker of Republicans and Democrats. America has done this before. We did it right after World War II. We put a committee together of Republicans and Democrats that looked at any place that they had duplication. It was the last time we had hit debt at 102% of our GDP. And they did it together. And when they found duplication that they could eliminate, they brought it directly to the floor. No amendments, voted up or voted down. We can't keep doing the same thing to solve the problem. We have to think differently. And we can't do it with just one party.
I think the speaker's right on all of that, that we do have to start looking at it different. And if we have something similar to what was done after World War II, even if we just went through the process and looked at every program that is duplicative in any way, shape, or form, and if you have a group of Democrats and Republicans who can look at it and say, you know what, do we really need these 20 programs to do one thing? Or can we combine all that and have some savings in that? And then bring it to the floor and just vote on it. This program and this program, they're duplicative. Let's get rid of one of them. Take a vote. And then everybody's on the record as to what they really want to do and how serious they really are in terms of controlling that spending and making sure that the programs are doing what they say they're supposed to do. Are they really having the right desired result? Now, we know the bill's passed. We know it's been tossed over to the Senate. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Senate would stay in session until they pass the debt ceiling bill, even if it takes all weekend.
The bill is now in the Senate, where we begin the process today of passing this legislation as soon as possible. The Senate will stay in session until we send a bill avoiding default to President Biden's desk. We will keep working until the job is done.
Leader Schumer also believes that the bipartisanship with which the bill passed is a good sign and that it should sail through the Senate with a minimum number of hiccups.
Let me say this. Last night's House vote was a resounding affirmation of bipartisanship, which I hope bodes well for quick movement here in the Senate. Large majorities from both sides came together to produce last night's 314 yes votes. Two-thirds of Republicans voted for it, and more than two-thirds of Democrats voted for it.
So that's where we are. And again, it's the beyond the headline stuff. The easy stuff is the easy stuff. And we will say that putting aside the panic button, which we've been telling you to put aside since January, can now officially be put in the door, in the drawer, and locked up. The important thing is the underneath pieces. How do they implement all of this? How do they make sure that spending caps don't get blown through? Those are important conversations. How do we make sure that there's a different way for Congress to actually do their job and to make sure they do their job when they're supposed to do it? We'll keep our eye on that and many other things that could be a direct result of some of the conversations, the negotiations, and the compromise that has taken place.
Think Again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Well, we're going to stay with a focus on the Senate. Actually, the Senate Project Series is where we're going to stay. The Orangey Hatch Foundation, of course, will be part of a third installment of the Senate Project Series. This is a really unique event. It brings together senators from different sides of the aisle and political spectrum for better debates about policy. Not personalities, not the politics, the policy component to all of this. These debates are held on the public stage for the American people to watch and to weigh in. And we want to take a look at what can we expect from this year's event? Why is it important to pay attention to it? And what role the Orangey Hatch Foundation plays in making all of this happen? And we're thrilled to have back on the program once again Matt Sandgren, who, of course, is the executive director of the Orangey Hatch Foundation. And Matt, welcome back.
Boyd, it's good to be back. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Well, you've got a great lineup coming up in the third installment of the Senate Project Series. Give us a sense.
Well, as you said in your nice lead up, and you've always been so gracious to the foundation, we are just honored and thrilled to be partnering with the Edward M. Kennedy Institute and the Bipartisan Policy Center in bringing, as you said, the third installment of the Senate Project Series up in Boston on Monday, June 12th. And we are having Senator Jeanne Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire, and Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, will be the two folks who will be joining Fox News's Brett Baer, who will be moderating that discussion. And what we hope to accomplish with this series is to really bring these folks together. Yeah, you might have different views politically, but that doesn't mean we can't come up with some sort of solution. And that is the end objective with this project. And it really is quite meaningful.
It's so important. And I love the way this comes together between the Hatch Foundation, the Kennedy Institute. I think those are just such important players to be there. And I think also Brett Baer does such a great job in these forums to just bring it together. I know he did the inaugural debate between Lindsey Graham and Bernie Sanders, which was a great, lively conversation, but respectful and honest and a real look and a chance for people to listen to differing points of view about the policy of it all. And what are you anticipating this time around with Senator Ernst, Senator Shaheen, and Brett Baer in the play?
Well, this time around, considering we're both these senators, they serve on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So I imagine there will be a little more of the foreign policy, military type discussions. Think Ukraine, Russia, China, Taiwan, who knows, maybe a little Iran. But it will be a fascinating discussion. And we, again, hope at the end that there's going to be some commitment to work together. I want to take a moment. If your audience hasn't read your op-ed, they really should. That the Hill op-ed that you published about being, is this our broken moment? We from the Hatch Foundation would agree with you. And this is where we find the opportunity for us to get together and work to see if we can find some, not only in a civil manner, but some solutions to get our country moving again. And that's what we've got to be focused on.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I love about the approach to all of this, because it's not asking anyone to go vanilla or mushy or squishy.
No.
It's be passionate about it. Let you have some dignity around it. And let's just have this. I always say America's at its best when we're this country of big ideas, open, even roiling debates about ideas, about policy. And it seems to me that this is what we have to get back to.
Right, and it's also what you say. You've said that a couple of times, and I think it's important to underscore policy, not personal attacks, right?
Yeah.
We should really keep those at bay. We do not need to go for the jugular, so to speak, and bring us down in the gutter. It really needs to be a civil discourse. We really need to bring back civility in the public square, and I that is what we're committed to as well. And, you know, I said one time on your program, we hope to bring one of these debates to Utah. We came close, and I think we're going to in the coming, hopefully in the near future. It's just been really hard, as you can imagine, with their schedules and their votes. Utah is a little harder than Boston at times.
Yeah.
But I trust me, I'm going to, if I have my way, we're going to be doing it in Utah one of these days soon.
That would be fantastic. And you do have to say, though, the Kennedy Institute does have a beautiful place to have this there. They have this replica of the Senate chamber, and it really does create the environment that we all ought to be expecting. So often we see the empty chamber and someone talking to the, you know, to the interns and the pages. But to have it in that replica Senate, I think actually adds a little power and dimension to it.
It's really odd, as you, as a former Senate staffer, you are as well as I am. It's really weird to walk onto that Senate floor. You feel like you're going, you know, someone's watching whether or not you're walking correctly in the right aisles, et cetera, as a staffer. And it is a flashback when you get there. They've done such a wonderful job. I might plug this, as Boyd, you always let me do this. We are looking to do another debate in the fall, but this time it will be in Washington, D.C., and I'm hoping it will actually be on the Senate campus.
Oh, wow.
Details to follow, but everyone should keep an eye open for it. You can go always to our website at orrinhatchfoundation.org, O-R-G, and that's with two R's, O-R-R-I-N, hatchfoundation.org. Learn about it, and you know we'll be live streaming that debate on June 12th. And we'll have it on our website that you can watch. They will have it under Fox Nation. That's a streaming services, but we will also have it on our site for folks to watch as well.
Awesome. I also know that Fox News Channel will actually air it on Sunday, June the 18th,
right,
at 8 p.m. Utah time. So also
exactly
important. So there's no excuse not to lean into this. And I actually think that Senator Ernst and Senator Shaheen are two extraordinary women who again, are focused so much on a lot of that international things, foreign affairs,
right,
and how that plays out. And I can't think of a more timely topic and a more timely set of senators who have both experience, not just in the Senate, but in their personal lives, that I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation.
Well, it gives you hope, Boyd, that these senators see the value of getting together in a venue and an event sponsored by the foundation. They see the benefit of doing this, and especially talking on these issues that are so important as we're watching what's happening over Ukraine and possibly with Taiwan and China. So it will be interesting. If you have any of those interests, you really should tune in.
Yeah, fantastic. And we'll, of course, cover that and give you some of the playback as that plays out. And we'll watch that very closely coming up. So, again, check that out coming up on June the 12th. Again, there'll also be a replay on June the 18th. You can also check it out at the Orrin G. Hatch Foundation. You can go to their website to check that out as well. Matt Sandgren, Executive Director of the Orrin G. Hatch Foundation. Matt, thanks so much for chiming in today. This is a great project, a great series, and we look forward to how this all plays out in the coming weeks.
Thanks, Boyd.
All right, and that's Matt Sandgren from the Orrin G. Hatch Foundation. And I love this series because I think they're bringing together some interesting conversations. And the fact that you can have a senator like Joni Ernst, who is going to be, I think in the next 24 hours, will be riding around on motorcycles across Iowa with many of the candidates running for president. It's their ride and roast that they do in Iowa. So that's a very political, very Republican thing. Gene Shaheen, of course, is a Democrat from New Hampshire. So they're coming from very different points on the compass, and yet they're going to sit down and have a meaningful debate about policy issues, not just the politics stuff. So I love that the Hatch Foundation is part of this conversation. Of course, they tag team that with the Edward M. Kennedy Institute. And Brett Baer from Fox News will be the moderator, who I think will do a great job in facilitating an elevated and meaningful conversation there as well. All right, we're going to go ahead and step aside for some bottom of the hour news. And we're going to stay with this congressional watch Hang around. Philip Wallach is going to join us next, senior fellow from AEI, and a really interesting conversation about Congress, the future of it. How do we make sure we maximize it? Stick around. That's coming up next on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
As we've been discussing all week this week, it is very clear that Congress is broken. The question is, will it be broken open? It has to be broken open for transformation to actually happen. Congress really is at an inflection point, and we've had the battles, the extreme partisanship, the dysfunction. Sadly, that's become the norm, not the exception in Congress. And so we want to look at, what's the way out? Is there a path out of the current morass? Is there a way for the legislative body to actually be a legislative body, a place for great debate and for ideas to drive and to have conversations in front of the American people that ultimately end up in good policy for the country, not for the politics and the performative politicians? Well, we're really pleased to have joining us on the program Phil Wallach, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies American separation of powers. And a great new read that everyone needs to check out, Why Congress. And Phil, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's dive into this. We're on the same page when it comes to believing that Congress is broken. The test is whether it can be broken open and transformed. And you've laid out some real plausible paths in terms of how do we actually get to deliberation, restoring the government's ability to work for the American people.
Yeah, so I think the bottom line of the book is that the way Congress is today is not the way it has always been. It has been a place with decentralized power centers in the past, and the reason it doesn't operate that way today, that it's dominated by sort of top partisan leaders whose main focus is making the other side look bad, that's really a function of choices that the members themselves have made in organizing their respective chambers. And the message of the book is really, in large part for them, you can organize this in a different way. If you want to be more meaningful legislators whose job doesn't just consist of pulling the lever the way your leaders tell you to and raising dollars, but you actually want to be involved in the work of legislation, of figuring out what kind of coalitions you can bring forth from the diverse elements of the American people, it's up to you. That option is on the table if you're willing to pursue it.
Yeah, and I love that because it is. It's different coalitions of governing and dealing with different issues in a different way. And one of the things that I love that you've attacked, Phil, is the fact that over time, because of this dysfunction and what they have allowed themselves to become, often it's working around Congress rather than through Congress, which is where things are supposed to be solved.
Yeah, I think when Congress allows itself to be a place where we settle for calling each other names and not coming to any decisions in the end, it's okay if we call each other names if we're willing to come to some decisions.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't mind the name calling so much, but when it decides to just sort of let the status quo ride and not pass new laws, well, power abhors a vacuum, and the executive branch and the courts come rushing in, and they become our primary policymakers. That just doesn't work very well. They're not well positioned to make legitimate policy, which is what Congress is there for.
Yeah. So you lay out in your book three plausible paths that Congress can take from here, and I want to dive into each of these because I think they're really fascinating to consider, especially in light of what we've been dealing with during the past few weeks. So let's start with this idea of decrepitude. Tell us what that is and why is that a plausible path? What do we need to do?
Yeah, unfortunately, all we need to do to get to the decrepitude scenario is sort of more of the same. Things that we've become pretty used to. So to be fair, the current Congress is not completely broken, right? I think there's a fair amount of hyperbole in the media when we talk about it. There's plenty of things that still work on Capitol Hill. A lot of them are lower profile, and things could get a lot more broken than they are. We could have a lot more government shutdowns. We could have a default on the debt one of these years. We could fail to properly fund our military. Mm. All those things are things we mainly managed to keep going for now. So if we keep letting the partisan enmity become sort of the be-all and end-all of Congress, I think even those things that work all right today are likely to decay,
yeah,
and leave us in a place where we really expect the executive branch to just work around, come up with weird legal arguments to do whatever it wants. That'll just become sort of the norm, and everyone will kind of say, oh, isn't it too bad we do things that way, but we'll get used to it.
Yeah.
To an alarming extent, we're already kind of used to that.
Yeah. When Congress fails to do its job or abdicates its power to the executive branch, regardless of which party's in the White House, will gladly use it, do things by executive orders, then things get involved in the courts. And that just
Absolutely.
Keeps rolling. And I love the way you described it, that it's a peanut gallery of angry onlookers. And so let's go to the next plausible path, which is really about just kind of the rubber stamp status.
Right. So I think sometimes when people think about reforming Congress, they think, oh, man, Congress screws everything up. What we need to do to reform it is make it less obnoxious, get it out of the way, basically accept the fact that policymaking is going to move into the executive branch and make sure that Congress is basically more pliant and goes along with what the president wants. And so in some ways, that is an appealing vision in terms of being able to efficiently make sensible policy. Like the executive branch does have some advantages by virtue of being unitary, of having one boss at the top of it. That makes things simpler, and that has some appeal. But at the same time, if we go that route, if Congress becomes this rubber stamp, we really lose the essence of politics.
Yeah.
We lose the essence of self-government, and we're going to feel more and more like we're just governed by some alien elite in Washington, which, of course, we already have a pretty strong sense of
what
today.
That looks like.
So that's a very dangerous scenario, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the way you framed it in the book, that Congress just becomes this venue for cheap talk, but no real meaningful deliberation or elevated dialogue. So that leads us to the last of the plausible paths for Congress, and that's renewal. Describe that for us.
Sure. So my sense of what's really at the essence of Congress comes from James Madison, and especially the very famous argument in Federalist Number 10, where he talks about the interplay of factions and creating a sense of balance and protecting against abuses by putting these factions into motion and sort of setting them against each other, setting them in the process of having to accommodate each other. And that's really what Congress needs to do. That's its institutional advantage, is to be a place where all these different factions can have voices and find ways of creating coalitions of strange bedfellows, producing unexpected things. Congress really ought to be a place of real interest, that surprising things come out of. You sort of mix up all the elements of American life and see what they manage to come up with together. It ought to be kind of surprising and not just a matter of implementing some predetermined partisan agenda. So the revival or renewal scenario depends on sort of restoring this sense of factional interplay, getting it so it's not just all about the two sides' top partisan leaders making deals in the back room, but actually sort of letting a broader mix of elements come into interaction with each other and seeing what happens.
Yeah, it's so important. This is an important read. Why Congress? Phil Wallach is the senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and this is what he studies: America's separation of powers. This is so important. Phil, I love the way you break it down in terms of some simple things that we can all wrap our heads around and say, wait a minute, that is what the Founding Fathers had in mind when they made a representative, deliberative legislative process to keep the country and the constitutional republic moving forward. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today. Great read, great insight and research as always, and we look forward to having you back to continue the conversation.
Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
All right, again, that's Phil Wallach, senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. The book, Why Congress? And it's really fascinating because it is right in terms of where we are, this decrepitude, that dysfunction reigns, and Congress just becomes a platform, a peanut gallery for angry onlookers. Or you can go the rubber stamp route that Phil pointed out, still nothing real significant. Congress becomes a place where a lot of talk but not a lot of meaningful deliberation takes place. Or we can get into renewal. And that's what we've been trying to focus on, that we know Congress is broken. Let's get it broken open and let's get it back a renewal to what the founding fathers had in mind with a representative, deliberative legislative process that is the indispensable pillar of the American constitutional system. That's where we want to get. That's the conversation we want to have. It leads to better governing. It leads to better policy, regardless of where you fall on things, because it'll be transparent. It'll be open. It'll be driven, not just by the voice of those that are in Congress, but by the voice of the American people. All right, we're going to step aside for a quick break, but don't go anywhere. When we come back, we'll be joined by KSL's Hugo Ricard Bell. We're going to look at how China is actually impacting the U.S. dairy industry, and even right here in the state of Utah. You don't want to miss it. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Get deeper insights on the news from inside sources.
Well, sometimes you have to look beyond the headline of what's going on, and sometimes you have to really look at the nuance of things that are going on to see how they actually impact us right here at home. Even a little spilled milk might have an interesting tie. Would you think that your milk and dairy today had a connection to China? Well, with the U.S.-Taiwan trade deal in the works, and of course we had spy balloons, we had tensions escalating between the United States and China, the relationship, of course, doesn't just impact national security. And the tensions between the U.S. and China are now actually trickling down to a little bit of spilled milk in the dairy industry. Really thrilled. KSL News Radio reporter Hugo Ricard Bell has done a deep dive into this story and how tension with China is impacting dairy right here in the state of Utah. Take a listen.
How you doing, man? So my name's Ron Gibson. I'm the owner of Gibson's Green Acres with my son, Bennett, and our farm's been in our family's name since 1869.
Quite the operation you got here.
Ron is a dairy farmer from Ogden. He milks around 1,500 cows three times a day, every single day. He's also the president of the Utah Farm Bureau.
Well, our dairy industry's just struggling like you wouldn't believe. I mean, I can't tell you how many dairies have gone out of business in the last 4 months in the state of Utah. I mean, we're getting real close to 100 dairies in the state now. Just 30 years ago, you know, we had 500.
Dairy prices across the United States have been steadily declining, and farmers like Ron are seeing this firsthand.
Last year, we were getting somewhere between $24 and $25 for our milk, and 100 pounds. For 100 pounds of milk, we get $24 or $25. This year, it looks like we're going to get somewhere between 15 and 17, you know, so that's a 40% decrease in income for us, and our costs haven't dropped a bit.
Now, there are several reasons for market fluctuations, things like consumer habits or supply chain issues, but Ron says this boils down to one key thing, a decline in dairy exports to one trading partner in particular.
You know, China, we become the last person on the planet they want to buy their products from. And they are not happy with us. And
so this part gets complicated, but here's what you need to know. China has a population of about 1.44 billion people. Now, naturally, they don't have a big enough dairy herd to supply everyone. So like most of the world, they import what they need, which includes milk products from places like New Zealand, Europe, and of course the USA. However, according to Ron, recently they've started to reduce how much dairy they buy from the United States.
You know, the barges are coming still from China to America full of their products, and they're going home empty because we're not sending anything back. And by and large, that is a big kick in the gut to agriculture, because when those barges are going back empty, that's a missed opportunity for a farmer and rancher in the United States of America.
It's not hard to see how Ron drew his conclusion. Remember, China is supporting Russia's war in the Ukraine and were accused of flying a spy balloon over the United States. So tensions between the two countries are high. But I wanted to hear from someone who's worked in international trade and has their finger on the pulse when it comes to U.S.-Chinese relationships.
Well, the trade relationship falls within the broader relationship, which has been obviously under some strain in recent years.
Stephen Lefevre is the chief of staff at the World Trade Center in Utah.
But on the whole, the relationship trade-wise has been declining in some ways, while also remaining constant in others, because our economies are quite intertwined, as you could imagine.
What have you seen within the dairy industry and our relationship with our trade to China?
Sure. You know, I look more at agriculture as a whole, and you look at that, and it's fairly stable. But as you break it down to your point, you see that, for example, livestock and dairy have declined. And specifically this year or the last year, it's been quite low relative to previous years.
The numbers stack up. Last year, Utah's dairy exports to China were a measly 25% from the year before. And when there's tensions between countries like we see with the US and China, they can use their intertwined trade relationships against each other.
Can you define to me what economic warfare means?
Essentially, it's using economic means to coerce your trading partners to make changes in their political or other behavior.
Is that something that you could attribute to what we might be seeing here?
I mean, we've seen it before with other countries. We've seen just generally as the geopolitical landscape has changed, as different political leaders have specifically, for example, wanting to bring more manufacturing back to the United States, that clearly is us signaling to China that we would like our American companies to produce their products in America. And likewise, Chinese government, the People's Republic of China, certainly have used economic means to make points of their own, political or otherwise.
Is there any reason, other than potentially antagonizing on a small scale the US, that China would be decreasing its importation of United States commodities like powdered milk?
I think both the United States and China probably are starting to think more long term, so it might be strategic, but it may be that they're starting to diversify. It could be that, you know, China is starting to view the United States as an unreliable trading partner, and at any minute they could lose the supply of critical things or important things, and so they may be just slowly shifting away.
At the end of the day, whether this is a strategic trade squeeze from China, or they are diversifying by sourcing from closer countries like New Zealand or Europe, for Ron Gibson and other farmers in Utah, it's having real impacts at the ground level.
We sit here in business losing, you know, 60, 70, 80, 100,000 a month trying to figure out how we can solve the problem. And the solutions are not great. You know, I deal with it every night. I was awake till 2 o'clock last night trying to think through what we're going to do. And farmers and ranchers are not okay right now. You know, they're really struggling. And for the most part, our industry is just in a tough spot.
That's KSL News Radio reporter Hugo Ricard-Bell, who actually joins us in studio now. And it's so interesting to me, Hugo, you did such a beautiful job of getting down to the essence of this issue. And again, a lot of people didn't get up this morning thinking, oh, yeah, warfare, tensions with China, it's got to be about dairy. Nobody's really thinking that. But one of the things that you got into there that I'd love to have you comment a little more on, give us some insight on this idea. We talk about military warfare. You mentioned economic warfare. And that often scrambles the politics a little bit here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, Stephen Lefevre said, economic warfare is all about putting pressure on certain trade relationships to maybe induce or influence political decisions. Something that was really interesting to me, talking to a number of different people who didn't feature in this, was something like a Republican government would be beneficial to a country like China. And so maybe they are squeezing an area where Republican voters come from, like agriculture. So who knows?
Fascinating stuff. Great insight. Great reporting, as always. KS on this radio. It's Hugo Ricard Bell. Deep dive on that story. Really important topics to be getting to. Hugo, thanks for joining us today. All right. That is going to wrap up our hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We're going to step aside for some top of the hour news, but don't go anywhere. When we come back, we're going to have my conversation with the United States Ambassador to Turkey, Jeff Flake, talking about the fallout from the recent elections in Turkey, the impact of the earthquake and some of the relief efforts going on there. We'll also be joined by Keith McMullen, CEO of Deseret Management Corporation, talking about an important symposium at the Vatican about faith in media and in popular culture and in art. Stick around for hour number two of Inside Sources coming up next.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, your all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson
on Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, Turkey has been in the spotlight this year, from massive earthquakes in February to NATO membership debates to the recent re-election of President Erdogan. All of these events have big implications, not only for Turkey on the world stage, but also for us right here in the United States. Someone who's been in the middle of many of those conversations and events is the United States Ambassador to Turkey, Jeff Flake, friend of the program who joins us on Inside Sources. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Turkey is increasingly playing an important role on the international stage, from NATO membership to Ukraine and Russia battles over shipping lanes. We're really pleased to have back on the program once again the United States Ambassador to Turkey, Jeff Flake, to discuss both the aftermath of what's been happening after the traumatic earthquakes and also the aftershocks of the recent presidential campaign. And Mr. Ambassador, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
As you continue to travel around Turkey and interact with your colleagues and counterparts there, give us a quick update and a sense in terms of the kind of the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes.
Well, obviously, it's been devastating. As you mentioned, we spoke about it before. 50,000 plus dead in Turkey and 10,000 or so in Syria. So they're still obviously recovering. It's kind of a different phase now. Everyone is in either tent housing or container housing with relatives or friends of those who are displaced, which are numbers in the millions. But they're rebuilding. Turkey builds fast, and they're rebuilding.
That's such an important thing. Give us a sense in terms of some of the needs there on the ground, things that you're interacting with from a government space. We also had Bishop Christopher Waddell of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who I know you visited with when he was over there working on some of those containers and some of those needs. But give us a sense both from the government standpoint and then kind of the NGO, nonprofit, faith-based groups that are helping out in that recovery and that rebuild.
Well, from the government standpoint, they want to make sure that this kind of devastation doesn't happen again, and that involves building to a higher standard than buildings have been built to before, and changing the way some of these cities look in these earthquake-prone areas. For example, I think residential buildings, and Turkey is very much vertical living. People live in apartment complexes here, and I don't think they've built a single-family home in 50 years anywhere in the country. But they've been usually high-rise apartments. Now, I think the highest residential housing will go to is four stories. So government is busy, with that aspect. In terms of the nonprofit sector, container housing is still going to be used for a while. As you mentioned, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is building a couple of container cities almost, as well as field hospitals. And it's not like there's triage still needed, which you might think of with a field hospital, but these are hospitals that replace hospitals that were leveled in the earthquake and are still going to be needed until new hospitals are built. And I think the church has actually built three of those field hospitals for the Turkish government and then turned them over. So it's been just heartening to see what people have done. Another Utah connection, Davis and Ajaline Smith from Cotopaxi were here to visit us. And he mentioned that the good folks at Cotopaxi, a Utah-based company, had contributed over $100,000, and they did more than $100,000 in sleeping bags, and wow. So more than $250,000 total just from one company for earthquake victims here. So it's really been heartening to see.
Yeah, that's great. It's amazing what happens when people can come together that way. It also just shows that resilience of the people of Turkey, their desire to rebuild, as you said, fast and to continue to move forward. Such an important conversation to be having there. And I want to shift now to the other rumblings in Turkey. Of course, the presidential runoff recently took place. Give us a sense of how that played out and then what that means moving forward.
This in Turkey, President Erdogan has been the head of state, either as prime minister or president, now for just over 20 years, and he just won another term, a second or third, depending on how you count it, as president. So he's the longest-serving Turkish leader, even more than Ataturk, the kind of founder of the modern state of Turkey. It was a bit of a surprise to many people here. Polling had the opposition winning, but President Erdogan won the initial election by just under 5 percentage points. So he's just under 50% that forced a runoff. That was held on Sunday. And in the end, it was 52-48%. And so it's the inauguration of the parliament will be tomorrow. I'll be there, as well as the swearing in of the president on Saturday.
That's an important thing. So give us a sense of what does that mean first as it relates just to the relationship with the United States.
Well, President Erdogan has kind of staked an independent path, if you will, playing a brokering role between Russia and the West, basically, in the war in Ukraine. Turkey has been very helpful in things like the grain deal, allowing grain to pass through the Bosphorus Straits and negotiating that deal with Russia. No country but Turkey could have done that, and then they did a good job with it. And they've also provided support in Ukraine. Turkey is a NATO member, longstanding, 70 years, and they have provided a lot of commercial sales of drones and other military equipment, but also have been a staunch supporter of Ukrainian sovereignty. Turkey has not imposed the same sanctions on Russia that the rest of the West has. It causes some consternation with some in the West. We're always pushing Turkey to do more in that regard, to stop the transshipment of items to Turkey, which they have done. And so we're continuing to work with them, but they have quite an independent foreign policy here.
Yeah, clearly. And I, as you mentioned, that that shipping lane in terms of the grain was such a crucial thing early on that, as you said, only Turkey could do that Black Sea grain corridor. That just simply would not have been possible by anyone else. What are some of the other things that are sort of on the horizon now? Some say this is, you know, a consolidation of power, and this is not good for the future of democracy in Turkey. What is your sense overall in terms of kind of the day-to-day? What are the people sensing there in the country?
Well, it is a strong presidency, and some will say that President Erdogan, the opposition, maintain that he has too much power here. Some have questioned whether a free and fair election could be had. Let me just say that, government here obviously has the advantages of any government in power in terms of patronage. And you know, you can certainly practice a populist measures, and then they have that benefit, certainly, and maybe not a level playing field in that regard in terms of freedom of the press and whatnot. And we express those concerns all the time, as does the rest of the Western world. But having said that, on election day, Turkey runs a free election. There were some in opposition circles, I guess, who were responding to people internationally saying that it wasn't a free election, and even the opposition, who lost, said, yes, it was. I can tell you, it was quite refreshing to me, coming from Arizona in particular. I thought it'd be nice to have a few politicians have that that kind of equanimity, where they recognize, you know, the playing field may not be completely level, but in the end, you have to trust elections. And in Turkey, the turnout was 88%.
Wow.
2 weeks ago, and then on the runoff election, it was 85%. And that's without compulsory measures either. And so this is a country in which there is suspense during elections. So you don't know the winner. And so we in the United States, obviously, We'll work with whichever government is elected by the will of the people, and we're determined to work with this administration here, this government here, to work on items of mutual concern.
Yeah, so important. And what a great lesson. More than a few lessons there in terms of who actually showed up to vote and the confidence that winners and losers both had in the process is real important. Very quickly, before I let you go, Ambassador, just want to circle back. You mentioned Turkey's longstanding space as a NATO member. What does this mean, this re-election of President Erdogan? What does that mean for Sweden and their application to become part of NATO?
That's a great question. That's one that is of immediate concern, obviously. President Biden called to congratulate President Erdogan and raised that in the call. Turkey approved Finland just a few weeks ago, so they're now a full-fledged member. But Sweden still needs assent of both Hungary and Turkey. And we expect that that will happen soon. Sweden has taken significant measures to address the concerns. And let me say, these are legitimate concerns that Turkey had in terms of tolerance for terrorism. But those measures have been taken. Just today, June 1st, a constitutional change in Sweden will take effect, giving Sweden the ability to crack down on terrorist financing that Turkey had insisted on. And so they have, we believe, Sweden has done everything they need to do to become full-fledged members, and we've encouraged Turkey to move forward quickly, at least in time for the NATO summit in Vilnius in July.
Fantastic. Wonderful insight, as always. Again, Turkey is such an important part of the world, playing an important role in so many different ways. And Ambassador Flake, we appreciate your leadership and your efforts there on behalf of the United States as well. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, and thank you. And thank you to the good people, like I said, of Utah, who have stepped up, in disproportionate ways to help with the earthquake. It's been gratifying to see. And much appreciated on this side. It really has been.
Important conversation there with the United States Ambassador to Turkey, Jeff Flake. And again, Turkey is going to continue to play a pivotal role in a crucial part of the world and have reach into many other places as well. And we appreciate the ambassador making time for us on a busy day today to give us some perspective in terms of that connection all the way back here to the state of Utah and many of the efforts that have been helpful following the earthquake.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Recently, there was an important symposium on the roles of news, media, and art in society, convened by a very unique organization. It was the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and Social Sciences at the Vatican. One who participated in that, Keith McMullen, who's the CEO of Deseret Management Corporation, DMC, which is the parent company here to KSL News Radio. And we're really pleased to have Keith McMullen in the studio with us today.
Thank you, Boyd. It's wonderful to be with you.
This was quite an extraordinary gathering at the Vatican in Rome. You were part of these important discussions. Give us a little sense of what was this group and what was this really all about?
It was really a privilege to be there. And the group was convened at the invitation of the this academy that you have spoken of for the purposes of deliberating on issues facing society today, and in particular how those issues might be resolved, such as they may need to be resolved, through the mediums of art and the news media and even the social sciences, as you have mentioned. There were many corporations that were represented there. Corporations that would be recognized by the general public, philanthropic organizations that were there, and we were invited to be there because of our commercial business enterprises in the media sphere, and others were there likened to us. So it was a very good opportunity to interchange with our associates in that field.
Yeah, and this is such an interesting, I want to make sure people understand that the history of this Pontifical Academy of Sciences and Social Sciences. This goes back to the 1600s, dating back, and it's an opportunity for people to gather, to learn from different entities. We know that one of the key players there, Cardinal Peter Turkson, of course, is the chancellor of that academy, and kind of handles a lot of the commercial businesses and entities related to the Vatican, and they bring in outsiders, not just other religious organizations, but business organizations, media, to have discussions about important topics. Mm-hmm. And so as you looked at that and experienced that, give us a little sense of what some of those conversations were like.
Well, first of all, the people came at the invitation of the Vatican. And that impressed me, that an invitation from the Vatican goes out and people respond,
and people come,
from all walks of life and from all of the various professions. And so we were in a group of people who had never met one another before, as far as I'm aware. Mm. And yet we had that invitation and we wanted to respond. It's quite a remarkable thing in and of itself. Now, with regards to what the setting was like in this storied and historical site, we had the opportunity of addressing issues regarding, in our specific field of interest, faith in the public square and faith in the media. There were others there who addressed the issue of art and others who spoke to the issue of social sciences. Of course, we focused on that particular area of interest in which we are engaged and found that the interchange of ideas with others who were there was very beneficial.
Yeah, so important. I love the visual of having you in a place where Galileo came to share some ideas. Keith, you're that kind of elevated thinker and get people moving. You had a chance to address the group. Give us a little sense of what you shared and why.
Let me start with Cardinal Turkson's opening remarks and a phrase that he used. He spoke of the various interests represented there in the room and even spoke to the configuration of the room, which is conducive to an interchange such as this. And then he said, there are different points of view. When he said that, points of view, it caught my attention because there in the room, various points of view were represented. Now, the challenge that we had was to share our points of view in a way that might be understandable by everyone else in the room. And so I was invited to say a few words. My remarks focused on some of the intrinsic common factors that all of us have. For example, in my judgment, and I so said, in every human being there is a spark of the divine. In every boy and every girl and every mother, every father, every man and every woman. That spark of the divine is eternal in its nature. And when we recognize that, our expressions and feelings that grow out of that have much more in common than we have differences. And so that was my hope of helping us all to appreciate the fact that we are sons and daughters of a loving Heavenly Father, and we are one great family. And if we can remember that, our common grounds can emerge quite readily.
Yeah. You oversee an amazing entity of different media groups, not just here in the state of Utah, but around the West and other places. One of the things that you mentioned in your comments in Rome was this importance to have this connection in media to deal with some of the fraying of the edges and the fringes of society, the fabric of society, as you laid it out. Dig into that for us a little bit.
You know, Boyd, I have thought a lot about that, and I know you have. You've spoken of it on this particular program a number of times. In this world of digital expertise and expression, in this world of opulence, in this world of isolation, all of which seem to compete for the human attention, we find people who are disappointed in the institutions that are traditional for us to rely upon. We find people worried about life itself and turning to their own resources for insights when perhaps they should turn inwardly and to their Father in heaven to find those insights that will sustain them. Now, as a consequence of those factors that I mentioned and many others in play, the media world tends to treat sacred things with the same kind of cynicism or, well, and sometimes sarcasm that we hope to dispel. We do not think that's healthy. And as we look at society and the contentious nature of it in all parts of the world, it's an outgrowth of this kind of fraying of basic values that have governed society for millennia. We hope to be a means of helping to address and resolve some of those problems.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the sarcasm or in many instances in media, faith was sort of just pushed aside for a long time. Some of it has more of that contempt and sarcasm that you described. Some of it is more caricatures of faith groups. What are you seeing, and what did you see in the context of those conversations at the Vatican in terms of ways to overcome that, to change the conversation as it relates to how faith is portrayed and covered and discussed in the media?
I saw two things that struck me as being relevant. One was this notion that we all have something intrinsic and in common that is divine. That, I think, is a very important notion. The other idea that I saw in that discussion was, if people don't find themselves relevant and in the discussion, in the listening process, they are very likely not to tune in or participate. Now, that's the challenge, in my judgment, of media, to make those two points apparent to the listeners. Yeah. So the listeners say to themselves, I relate to that. I believe in that. And I'm interested in that. And as a consequence, they engage. Today's media goes for sometimes the salacious, certainly the things that attract attention and cause revenues to be generated and other pressures to be placed on journalists who might be more objective under a different kind of set of pressures.
Yeah.
So awakening that notion that we in the media have the privilege of helping listeners to discover the common ground in which they share with all of their other fellows and here upon the earth, and then seeing how what is being talked about is relevant to their feelings, feelings that they might not have thought about for some period of time, but when it strikes that responsive chord, they want to be a part of it. I think that's the challenge that is before us and one that we are very happy to be a part of.
We're going to stay with the conversation more with Deseret Management Corporation CEO Keith McMullen about an extraordinary gathering at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and Social Sciences at the Vatican, exploring faith in the media and what it means to you. More of that coming up next on Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
If you're just joining us, we have the privilege today of sitting down with CEO of Deseret Management Corp, Keith McMullen. Keith, of course, has experience in all kinds of areas of business and faith. He was a member of the presiding bishopric of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and again, now is CEO of DMC, which is a parent company of KSL News Radio and other entities here in the Valley. And Keith, as we continue this conversation about your experience in Rome, this very interesting conversation about faith, how it's portrayed in the media, how it's portrayed in pop culture. We've talked a little bit about the way those caricatures play out and how we have to change that. I want to shift for a minute now and talk a little bit about faith as a dimension of diversity. Many businesses are starting to see that this is actually something that's important. How is the media starting to look at it maybe a little different than they have in the past?
We have studies that demonstrate that people feel a kinship to deity. And as a consequence of that feeling, which I've characterized, and I believe it's so, that spark of the divine within us, they desire to give expression to those feelings. Now, as we look at the landscape through our studies, there are some startling things that start to emerge. First of all, the media typically only gives soundbite attention to faith and religion, for the most part. And that soundbite attention is often in the extreme, playing on the salacious or the unfortunate incidents in society. And people of faith find themselves jaundiced, both by what they see and hear, and I think by reticence to put forward those things precious to them for fear that they might not be acceptable or might be attacked even in this contentious world in which we find ourselves. So, with that as a backdrop, then our survey says, wait a minute, 180 million people in the United States pray every day. I've never heard that. And there the research shows. And that says to me, my gracious, there is a commonality here that far exceeds what anyone is reading about in the public media. So that's, you know, that's 61% of this population of this country. And it's a remarkable thing. Now, do they all pray the same? Of course not.
Yeah.
We are a melting pot of the peoples of the earth. But they have a desire to connect with that sacred part within themselves and with their Heavenly Father or their God, in whatever form that might be in their minds. And I think we, as fellow citizens here upon this earth, have the obligation to respect those sacred moments and those sacred feelings, allowing people, even encouraging people, to express those innermost treasured feelings that they have. And as we do, we will find that contention has no place in society. Mm. Brotherly love and mutual admiration and respect and assistance to one another will begin to emerge. We have seen that in this state. We have seen that in the Intermountain West. We've seen that in our history. And I believe we can see it in the populations at large across the societies of this great earth of ours.
So important. And I know that you were part of this symposium because, again, the Pontifical Academy of Sciences and Social Sciences convenes so that they can learn from people from the outside in different, again, whether it's faith groups, businesses, NGOs, they're always learning. What did you learn as a result of being part of this symposium?
I learned that there are people, noble, capable individuals, leaders, at the heads of various organizations who have these same values that I've just referenced, and they are urgent. They are urgent in their concerns. They feel that we are at a position in society and in societies where something must be done. I think the Vatican's invitation to come together and deliberate over these things was timely. And the people who were there, they were most open and interested in sharing one another's views and finding common ground in which we could unite. I mean, if we take the notion of business and media and arts and sciences, which are often expressions of how we feel or perceive things, and say, what can we all do to enhance the opportunities that are before us and dismiss these divisive influences that are there, we have quite a combination of resource gathered under one roof. And all of the people that I met there were intent on discovering how that could be done. Now, no one knows how it can be done yet because we're on the very cusp of this. We're starting down this road, but we know the truth of things, and we know that we have the resources. And we understand that if we all marshal together in the right way, we can change the course that we're currently confronted with. So I came away heartened by the time there, and I was edified by the exchange I had, both with Cardinal Turkson and others who were part of the symposium.
So important. And as we look at it, as you said, we're beginning to kind of on the cusp of the cusp of getting some of this going. What's the therefore what takeaway? What do you hope happens differently or better as a result of the symposium?
Well, I always believe that what needs to be improved should start with ourselves. So I say to myself, in terms of the resources that are under the umbrella of Deseret Management Corporation, KSL and its affiliates, the television and radio outlets, our publishing arms, our news and commentary and its coming in its various forms, both in print and digital, I say to myself, we can demonstrate how to do this. And I think we do. Day in and day out, I am very, very pleased with our people. But if we can show how it's to be done from our perspective, we can then share it with others. And others are anxious to discover it as well. And we're not alone in this space. There are others who are making significant strides. But we are all in our own little environs, doing our own little things. And what I'm hoping is that as we convene in settings such as we are referencing or addressing today, we will find common ground where we can have common efforts. And that will pay great dividends for the people whom we serve.
Yeah. Fantastic. Keith McMullen is the CEO of Deseret Management Corporation. We call him the Galileo of the eighth floor now. That's going to be your official title, Keith. And again, this was an extraordinary symposium on the role of news, media, and art in society convened at the Vatican inside their Pontifical Academy of Sciences and Social Sciences. I think this was a most important and a historic. Those first meetings are important. Especially ones that are followed by real innovation and transformation. And Keith, thanks for giving us perspective on a most important beginning.
Thank you, Boyd, and continue your fine work. You're a blessing and a real asset to this entire community.
Well, it's important as we look at having faith in America. I think really does begin with faith in America. It also includes faith in the media, and a lot of transformation has to happen in our homes and neighborhoods, and in the media, and in government. And in all the institutions. And so it begins with that faith. And I think this is an important discussion. Again, really a great opportunity to have the CEO of Deseret Management Corporation, Keith McMullen, on the show with us today. All right, we'll go ahead and step aside for one last break. When we come back, when it comes to a vacancy in the House of Representatives representing Utah's 2nd Congressional District, hurry sickness, respectful restraint, and the power of a pause, why they all matter, coming up next. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back. Final segment of Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. As always, it is great to be with you. I am Boyd Matheson. And as we round out the program today, of course, a lot of talk over the last 48 hours about a vacancy in the House of Representatives, Utah's 2nd Congressional District, with of course, Representative Chris Stewart, after five and a half full terms in right now, will be stepping aside. That was made official yesterday, announcement from the congressman. Following that, there was an immediate rush to the microphones, a rush to the TV cameras, a rush to the social media platforms, and everyone started moving towards positioning to run for the seat. To me, this is one of those, regardless of which side of the aisle you are on, there were people from both the left and the right jockeying for position and trying to be first in, first out when it comes to running for what will be an open seat in the 2nd Congressional District. To me, this is one of those, just because you can, doesn't mean you should. And we have this hurry sickness in our society that often prevents us from showing respect and restraint and actually being able to just take a pause. And why that is so important. We're in such a rush. Before the ink had even dried on the congressman's letter, many were rushing to the microphones, the cameras, and social media to be first in, to be the first to declare, to jump in the fray, or to say, I'm seriously considering. And I think that's wildly inappropriate. When you have someone stepping down, someone who has served our state and our country well, someone who is stepping down to address illness in the family with the representative's wife, and we wish them all the best. And that's why, to me, can you not wait? Could you not wait a nanosecond? I really think that running for office is something that should be a very deliberate decision. It should never be a reaction to what somebody else has done or hasn't done. It's a deliberative process. And I worry that in our rush for someone to have a platform, not a position, a platform for whatever their agenda might be, we end up in this space of hurry sickness once again, which rarely leads us to get the best candidates, to make the best decisions, or to do the things that will actually be best for the greater good. And so to me, it's one of those moments of, can you show some restraint? Some of you have heard my conversation that I had a couple of years ago with Bob Woodward, of course, from Watergate fame. And he emphasized over and over to me during the course of this interview what his publisher, what his editor would tell him. They had so many pieces of the Watergate case put together, and they wanted to go. They wanted to be first in. They wanted to be the first out. They wanted to be the one to break the story. And the editor, Mr. Bradley, would continually slap the copy and say, no, you're not there. Just wait. Restraint always works. Restraint always works. And restraint always shows respect.
which I think is an important thing when you're especially looking at someone running for public office. And so this rush to figure out who it's going to be and what the odds are and what the field looks like, to me, is indicative of the problem that we have in our politics today. Because everybody's in a rush. Everybody's in this hurry sickness mode. We have been conditioned and we've taught ourselves to hurry inappropriately. We're sort of like Pavlov's dog. It was amazing yesterday. As soon as the bell rang and there was a formal statement from Representative Stewart saying that he would indeed resign to be able to address better his wife's health condition, that it was the right decision for their family, the bell rang and everybody started salivating. Everyone started racing around. Everyone started trying to make sure they could be first in, have the hot take, be the one to break the story. And to me, that's why our politics are so broken. Is because we're not willing to show restraint. We're not willing to say, okay, that's a decision. There's another part of that decision that has to be made. He has to formally inform the speaker and the governor. He also has to set a date of departure. All of this is not going to be done in an instant. So the rush is really pretty irrelevant. And it's a distraction. And again, I think it's disrespectful. Regardless of who the candidates are, I don't care if they're Republicans, Democrats, United Party, or anybody in between. To me, there's just a moment where you just pause and you show restraint for the office, respect for the process, and then you get in. And then you go at it and you have a great campaign. Everybody goes to town, makes their case, puts forward their vision, their principles, their policies, and the voters can vote and decide. And then we march the Republic forward. But when we're racing and chasing all the time, all we get left with is clickbait, headlines, social media banter, and fundraising emails. And I think we can do better. I think we are better. To me, it speaks volumes about those who can't show restraint. Without restraint, we get lost in the process of arguments and personalities. And so I'm just going to advise just a little caution and a little restraint. I think it's respectful. I also think it's important. It also shows the discipline of a campaign. We spend a lot of time on this program talking about the communication strategy, not just the politic strategy, not just the policy strategy. There's a communication strategy as well. And I think those rushing and racing in are making a mistake in terms of communication strategy. I think better to show some restraint, lay out a vision. Why are you running for this? Why does this matter? Why this seat? Why now? Make a case, not just an announcement, because it's not about the announcement. It's about what comes next. I see a lot of politicians who are really good at announcements. They're great at a social media post. They're really good at getting a hot take and a zinger that'll be picked up on a cable news network. But they're pretty weak when it comes to what governing actually looks like. And so we need to avoid this hurry sickness that has taken over the country and just show a little restraint. Show that you have the ability to pause and to reflect rather than just react in a Pavlovian kind of way because there's an opportunity in front of you. And there'll be plenty of time for debates. There'll be plenty of times to get in to the heart of the issue. But we're never going to get there if everybody's always racing and chasing to be first in, to have the hot take. We have to do it a little bit different. And so that's part of what we have to do as citizens and voters is make sure we're listening for the right things. Not the big splash, not the immediate reaction. Anybody can do that. A real leader understands how to overcome hurry sickness, show respectful restraint, and to pause before making a big decision or launching a big effort. That'll wrap it up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. I am Boyd Mathison. Thanks for joining us today. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL. KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.